Well, since there is only one left, I contemplated the masses of materials strewn around on the floors and beds of four bedrooms upstairs at home, and my own downstairs, decided, what will I talk about this last time? Would be some favorite themes, but no, there's some things that should be touched on before we leave them, because I haven't even made a dent in the junk I've got there. You have no idea how, well, you can imagine it's accumulated for years. So, and it's time that was being cut short in righteousness, too. So I'm going to talk about a thing that I think is rather significant. It's this. It's the name here. Yeah. I don't have the pointer, but that doesn't make any difference, I guess. Is there a pointer here? No pointer. I guess it's rude to point around here. Yeah, thanks. There we go. There it is. I don't want that one. I want the other one. Here we go, eh? How about number one? Great. Gadfree. Here we go. Now, it's this name here, of course. And you notice the name is Sheshonq, and give life to the Ba, to the spirit of the Osiris Sheshonq, who's dead. Now, the first word recognized by the experts on the Joseph Smith hypocephalus was that, the only. It's the only word recognized, as a matter of fact, for many years. And it's very obvious, it's a Sheshonq, because there were great kings, it's a very important name. Now we can move to the other one. Oh, I can press the button myself. That's progressive. There, now that's King, one of the Sheshonqs, the Sheshonq kids of the 22nd dynasty. They were great kings, and this is a famous silver sarcophagus in the Cairo Museum. My boy Charles took that picture, and he took this one too. But here's the name on the sarcophagus. There it is. You see the same one as you saw on the hypocephalus there, the Sheshonq. Sheshonq, it says Moriamun. Good Book of Mormon name. This family went by the name of Moriamun. Moriamun Sheshonq, there's his name there, you see. And so that's worth talking about, because that name has lots of connections. You'd be surprised. De Verrier, in 1896, read these four lines in the block there that you saw. He read it, O great God in Sechem, O great God, Lord of heaven, of earth, and of underworld, O Osiris Sheshonq, and that's all he puts in. He identifies the party then as none other than Sheshonq the first of the Bible. And he identifies him as that, and together with the name of Sechem, which was Abraham's first settlement in Palestine, where he first sacrificed, this could well have raised a few eyebrows because it connects very closely with Abraham. Sheshonq has many connections with Abraham. A generation later, Jean Capart read the same lines, O God in the heavens, God primeval, God great who has made the heavens, the earth, the world infernal, give life to the soul of the dead man Sheshonq. Though Sheshonq was a fairly common name of the late period, well, it wasn't fairly common, it was rather rare, but it does exist. The name on the silver coffin we just showed you is still the only historic name on any hypocephalus. Now, this is why it's important. It's the only historic name that's been able to place on any hypocephalus, and it's the only Egyptian name closely connected at all with that of Abraham. Quote, for starters, De Verrier's linking of both Sechem and the Bible with the owner of the Joseph Smith hypocephalus might have raised a few questions by identifying it with Sheshonq I, the founder of the 22nd dynasty in Egypt. A name, he says it's a name unknown before the 22nd dynasty in the 9th century, actually it was the 10th century, early 10th. De Verrier thought to discredit Joseph Smith because it can't be as old as Abraham, because the first time the name is mentioned, he says, is in the 9th century here with this Sheshonq. Well, that was a very serious mistake for him to make. Now we're going to do some heavy skipping here. Who were the historical Sheshonq kids? And why was that strange name chosen to designate both the mystical first pharaoh and the legendary last pharaoh? They were both designated by the name of Sheshonq, a strange thing. The first and most celebrated name was Sheshonq I. This is the third here. The first king and founder of the 22nd Sheshonqid dynasty, whose foreign origin, as Gardner puts it, was betrayed by such barbarous names as Shoshank, Osakan, and Tekelot. Notice the Osakan, Sargon, Tekelot, Tiglath. They sound Assyrian. This led to lots of argument, you see. But he says they're closely akin to Libyans. Well, there was a big fight after whether the family was Asiatic or whether it was African, whether it was Libyan or whether it came from Elam. Patri is the most outspoken here, lots of argument here. He says on the subject, Sheshonq I was the leader of a fighting body of men headed by condottieri, such as the Persian or Elamite Sheshonq. The leader Sheshonq entered Egyptian service with his men and settled at Bubastis. This movement started about 970 BC. Naturally, it links Sheshonq, Shishak of the Bible, which means man of Susa. That's the city of the kingdom in the northeast part of the, in the southeast part of Iraq, it would come in that area, entered the Egyptian service. The name Shishak is that of the national god of Elam. Shishak is the name of the national god of Elam, the Elamites, same country, and worshipped at Susa. He was also a great deity among the Persians. About 1000 BC, pressured by the advance of Assyria, a gang of Turkestan men began moving on Babylonia and so forth. And he says our excavations at Gerar have produced repeated evidence of a movement from Central Asia to the west about this time. So this is an Eastern Sheshonq. Well, we don't have the time to go into this big argument whether it's Shushanak of Susa, which has been recently maintained, or whether it's the other. Edward Meyer, for years he argued that the family came from Asia, but later he changed his mind and decided they were Libyans. Clearly there was something to be said for both theories. Well, they made their capital, the Sheshonqids made their capital at Bucyrus there, and there were warrior castes, and they were allowed to rule the city, and and later he became, of course, he took over, he had enough power. They're military governors of the area, and for five generations in that particular area, around Heracleopolis, and then they spread around. But, Jerome equates Sheshonq to Babylon, of all things, according to the Kabbalistic Gematria. And finally, there was the attachment of the name to the oracles. As soon as he assumed the throne, Sheshonq I went out and founded a temple at the Karga Oasis, and the temple of Ammon there, and the Sheshonq III and left there the beautiful, the famous Litany of the Sun out there on the temple walls, way out there at the Oasis of Karga. And more Sheshonqs. They invade the desert, and so they establish it, Amun's Shrine and Selah and so forth. And if it had been any other name, would still bring the case of Sheshonq at least the best possible illustration of what the Abraham story is all about. The only time Israel and Egypt are rivals for world power is when a Sheshonq is involved. In fact, Sheshonq is the Egyptian label for Kosmokrator, the ruler of the world, the man who claimed to rule the whole world. There are a number of those. And he was the great Kosmokrator. Well, he was the mortal rival, a friend, diplomatic rival, of the only great Israeli Kosmokrator, who was Solomon. It was Sheshonq I who gave his daughter to Solomon in marriage, and he got Gerar in the Gaza Strip as his dowry. The dowry came with the woman, and we're told that the three buildings Solomon built, the first was the temple, the second his own palace, and the third was the palace he built for the wife of Sheshonq I, the founder of the 22nd dynasty of Egypt. Then there was this tension, all this, won't go into this juggling around, it has to do with Hadad going around and then marrying an Egyptian princess, and under Jeroboam they were going to get their revenge. Egypt wanted to take over, and in about 930 this Sheshonq went and sacked the temple of Solomon and Jerusalem and took the treasures back to the temple at Heliopolis and transplanted the rites of Jerusalem to Heliopolis. This close connection, always related to Sheshonq. He takes it back and does that. He is the Egyptian Solomon, in other words, transfers the temple and the like with Jeroboam's assistant. Well, another Sheshonk, succeeded not Horus but Nevis, and credits him. Well, now, there are the legendary, the mythological Sheshonks, a great, great many of them. And that is, we're told, Theopompus says, Sheshonk was the first to rule all Egypt after Horus, the son of Isis, and Osiris. First of all, he was the first pharaoh. We often hear that. He was the first man to teach horse riding, the cavalry. It was really Horus who taught men to ride, says one, but it was Sheshonk who, filled with overweening pride and urge to empire, started the mounted cavalry. There's an Asiatic tradition, you see. Another report has Sheshonk succeeding not Horus, but Nevis, and credits him with making laws governing the worship of the gods, the discovery of geometry, and the study of the stars. There's a Sheshonk wherever you turn around here, which is a very strange thing. But they do take us into the Ammon tradition when they report, is written, that Ptah appeared to Sheshonk's father in a dream and said that he would have a son who would rule the entire world. And then, in India, Sheshonk was Osiris, Sesaos, and he had been equated with Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mortals, and display, who in turn is equated with Ramses II. You get all mixed up here. Consistent with aspirations to world empire, he was also the founder of the warrior caste and cult, along with the worship of the gods and study of the stars. With his warlike stance, he introduces cavalry, as Diodorus and Herodotus tell us that. Well, the great Horus, rescuer of his father. Now, the greatest person to bear the name of Sesostris, of Sheshonk, was, but who was he? We've got to get Sesostris in here. Some say that Sheshonk, the son of Horus, fell away from the teachings of his father because of pride and ambition, and some say he was first man to Mount Horus. We saw that. But it would seem that the legendary Sheshonk has a close parallel in the legendary Sesostris. Now, Sesostris is the same as Sheshonk, we see. The king of Egypt, Kat Exoke. He, like Sheshonk, now this is Sesostris, you see. Didn't put his picture up. He was a real king, and as Sheshonk founded the 22nd dynasty, Sesostris founded, actually Amenemhes did, but to fit the pattern, Sesostris had to found the 12th dynasty, which is the greatest dynasty of all. So we have two dynasty founders, one by the name of Sesostris and the other by Sheshonk, but they're hopelessly confused. The one is often labeled Sheshonk, the other is often labeled Sesostris, because they made the same conquests and did the same things and had the same myths about them and everything else. Something is wrong here. This has to do a lot with how good traditions are. Do we know anything at all about anything? So we're told Sesostris founded the 12th dynasty. Tradition had it that he was the first king of the dynasty, even though he followed Amenemhes. He too, like Sheshonk, restored the old religion, which included human sacrifice, Allah Abraham, and especially concerned with cosmology. It was the second Sesostris, not Sheshonk, who invented horseback riding, according to another tradition. They're mixing up already. And he conquered all the world as king of kings. He was the first cosmocrator. He was, says a Byzantine writer, king of the Assyrians, that famous Sesostris who yoked kings to his chariot and called himself cosmocrator. Constantly, and that is most significant. According to Manetho, one of our best sources, exactly 1,000 years before Sheshonk founded the 22nd dynasty, another Sheshonk, and he calls him Sheshonk, you see, Sesonkis, founded the great 12th dynasty. And Josephus insists that Manetho got his names all mixed up. He wrote Sheshonk for Sesostris. And Sather has pointed out that each name is found written in a variety of ways, so much alike that they sound a lot alike to begin with. It's not surprising that they got mixed up, he said. Well, thus the world benefactor of Heracles was named Shu Sosis. I say Isis herself is called Saosis. Sethos the first is confused with Sethos the first, I've got to talk slower, was confused with Sethosis, who is confused with Seosis, who's confused with Sesostris, the last being identified both with the Sesostris of Dynasty 19 and the Senostret, the Greek form Sesostris, the third of the 12th dynasty. Justin Martyr borrows the entire Sheshonq story of Diodorus I, customarily attributed to Sesostris under the name of Sesonkosis, and rendered by Sesonkis by Manetho and Sesonkosis by Eusebius. All of these, Edward Meyer argues, are just thinking of Sheshonq I. But Theopompus insisted that Sheshonkis, who was the first king of all Egypt after Horus, the son of Isis and Osiris, was actually Sesostris. Athenodorus says that Sesostris, to make an image of his grandfather Osiris, brought foreign workers to Egypt. And Serapis was his funeral name. They've even mixed Serapis up with it here, you see. When Darius I, whose empire was the greatest to date, he was a great world conqueror too, he conquered Egypt, he mounted the throne of Pharaoh, and what do you think? He took the name of Sesostris as a matter of policy. And he imitated, we're told, the, Diodorus says, he imitated the megalopsuchia, the arrogance of the archaic kings of Egypt and their manner of lives, and after their death was honored accordingly. His great architectural work, this is the one we talked about, was the temple at Cargo at the Oasis in honor of the god Ammon. Thus the names Seoosis, Sesonkosis, Sesostris reverberate down the ages. We're quoting Seta now, Kurt Seta, as the model, the forebuilt, followed by Nectanebus and Ptolemy, Nectanebus being the last legitimate pharaoh, Ptolemy being the first legitimate pharaoh of the new Ptolemaic dynasty. The first ones always take the name Sesostris, first or last. If you're an important innovator or excavator, that's a new word, you take the name Sheshonq. And immediately the possessor and successor of Alexander, who called himself Sheshonq. That was his only name he took. Well, Manetho makes Abraham, now the point is this, Manetho says Abraham's pharaoh was Sesostris, and Monte recently agrees. Usually Sesostris I is accepted as Abraham's pharaoh. That's why it's important, because this name Sheshonq is equated, both Seta and Case write it hyphenated. The same as hyphenated. We say Sheshonq Sesostris. And this name Sheshonq could very well be the pharaoh of Abraham. Is this a historical document or something like that? Well, who knows? Both figures were noted for their exceeding piety. Both revived the old religion, including human sacrifice, even of the pharaoh. This again puts us into the Abraham picture. Another story by Herodotus in the same tradition. This time it was that Pharos, which is the alternate name of Sheshonkit, the other name which is used is Pharos, the first use of the word pharaoh, and the son of Sesostris who attempted to control the elements and so forth. That name is used because it's actually true that the Sheshonq was the first person to call himself pharaoh. They say he's the only pharaoh named in the Bible too, connect up with everything. It is precisely in the dynasty of Sheshonq, this is important too. You notice all the three facsimiles, they overdo the lotus. There's a lotus in facsimile one where there isn't a lotus in any of the others, and with figure two and so forth. There's an extra lotus with figure three. There's a lotus along with Abraham's sacrifice. There's a lotus very conspicuously in facsimile number three in the reception scene. But it's very interesting that the lotus was the official flower of the Sheshonkid dynasty. It received special attention. Under Sheshonq himself, lotuses were sold to commemorate accessions or a claim to the kingship when the claim is not strong, or a said festival. The symbol on the infant on the lotus at Hermopolis is connected with some event in the reign of Sheshonq the First. They're always using lotuses. It was a great New Year's mystery drama of the god in which they celebrated the lotus. But just this family, the lotus is there. I say the family is overdone. The lotus is overdone in this hypocephalus. From early period, we find the lotus, we're quoting Spanton now, closely associated with the Egyptian gods and kings, but it seems to be part of the great religious revival of the Sheshonkids, where a single statue of Hapi with an altar before him is crowned with lotuses, and the well-known figure in the British Museum dedicated by Sheshonq. Thus, it is more than a heraldic plant, we're told, signifying the land of Egypt. It is a special emblem and power and dignity of kingship of the family which entertained Abraham. if you're going to follow legends here. It will also be recalled that Abraham's attempt to sacrifice also involved there's another overlap, but Sheshonq I is accused of pirating the monumental claims of Ramses III. Well, Ramses should complain about pirating, shouldn't he? He was the greatest of them all. Now, but he gets into the picture all over the place now. That was fair enough, since Ramses II was notorious for that. Sheshonq has left us a great relief on the walls of the temple at Karnak, and this is another very important point. I'm the one to move on here. What have I done with my machine? Oh, here we are. Now, see, this is the temple at Luxor. Sheshonq I. It's good I don't list badly, isn't it? What if I list? Wouldn't this be some talk if I was the first? Shibboleth, this is my shibboleth, you see. It shows we're Anglo-Saxon here. But this is the great inscription that from his Palestinian conquest, when he sacked Jerusalem, that Sheshonq I set up in the wall of the temple at Luxor. And it's still standing there, and it is the only case in all of Egyptian that we have the name of Abraham appearing. It's written out, the name of Abraham. And it's in this inscription of Sheshonq I. Everywhere they run into each other, these two men. It's like saying, haven't we met before, or something like that, because you don't seem to get away from him. So, let's see. Get closer up here. Yes, we can do this here. Now, here's a close-up of it, and here is the name of the man here, of Abraham. See, the field of Abraham. Some read this not Hekel, but Hekel either, the field or fortress of Abraham. This was the place that he conquered. See, these are fortified towns, and this was called the field of Abraham here. And this is, so here you actually have the occurrence of the name of Abraham, and it is the only occurrence in all of Egyptian where you find the name of Abraham written in hieroglyphic or in Egyptian. And when they discovered it, there was great excitement, of course. The renowned first conqueror is a quotation, an explorer of all the lands among the pharaohs was Sesostris, that is Ramses II, we're quoting one writer, identified on the other side with Heracles, for which reason Alexander was bound to have himself proclaimed at the oracle of Ammon as the son of Ammon, that's true, but the name he took to himself, of course, was Sheshonq, but that's way back Lepsius talking there. Laman first suggested that the fame of Ramses I was confused with that of Seti I, his father, and so, in turn, with Sesosis, and Sesostris of the 19th dynasty, this is another one. While the common interpretation, though not universal, is to identify another famous Sesostris with Senwosit III of the 12th dynasty, we're told that. The families of Ramses II and Sheshonq I were actually intermingled. That's a long story. Sheshonq I and III stole wholesale from Ramses at Tanis when they built that capital there. He'd already built there and they took stuff away and used it in their own buildings. Sesostris is Ramses II in Herodotus and Diodorus and Josephus and so forth. Well, this is the Pharathon or Pharaoh which the Sefer Hayashar and Artapenus, the two oldest Hebrew sources perhaps we have, view as the Pharaoh of Abraham. This Sesostris. They say he's Ramses II, but he was also the Pharaoh of Abraham. And Sincellus identifies with Ramsomenes, the first man to be called Pharaoh. We mustn't overlook the most interesting ties between Abraham and Sheshonq. His great relief on the wall at Karnak contains the only appearance, as we say, of the name there. Brest's identification of this name as the field of Abraham in 1906. Then the most interesting names, 71 and 72, they also appear here. And it's called Abraham, the Hekel Abraham, which can be nothing else, he says, than the field of Abram. He says, Breasted says, we already have the name of Jacob in the list of Thothmes III and probably also that of Joseph. We might therefore expect to find the name of Abraham, especially at this time, when he's invading Palestine, of course. And very closely connected with Solomon, with the ruling house of Palestine. For years they got along with each other for diplomatic reasons before, at the death of Solomon, perhaps the invitation of Jeroboam Sheshonk came and sacked the temple of Solomon. This has been confirmed by the generally accepted now that what this is. And so, he also notes the striking succession of parallel names mentioned by Monte here. You get Sheshonk matches Shushanak of Susa, Osarkon, who is the next king in order of that dynasty, Sargon, Takalot, the next one, Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian, and so forth. And the next one was Namrot, or Nimrod, whose name is the commonest. Now, this we run into all the time, and this is very important. It was Sheshonk's first important expedition of many, says Monte, who sees him giving asylum to Jeroboam against Solomon. Well, that's some historical stuff. He says, well, we skipped the historical part, Adam, Edom, and so forth, but then what happens is, I wanted to jump over something. It was very interesting now. The striking succession of names, well, to get on here. How this, the name comes down. We come here to, our story begins here now with the greatest Sheshonk of them all. And what was I talking about the last time? We'll come back to it. The story begins with the last true pharaoh of Egypt, who was Nectanebus II, 360 to 343. He was a great magician and sorcerer, we're told. He fled his country, which in spite of his matchless scientific and magical achievements had been conquered for the second time by the Persians under Artaxerxes III. The fugitive became a wanderer and a figure of romance, a very famous figure of romance. A prophetic text, the mysterious Demotic Chronicle, tells how Nectanebus will someday return to Egypt and liberate his kingdom from the oppressors, the Persians. In his travels, he came to the court of Pella, the court of Philip of Macedon, the seat of Philip of Macedon. While that king was away campaigning, and he consorted with Queen Olympias while he was there in the mystical guise of the god Ammon. He told her fortune. He carried with him a hypocephalus. He carried with him, it's described as a round star chart, and it describes it with it surrounded by the ocean, with the stars divided into three parts and so forth. But from that, he would tell her fortunes from the stars. He'd become a quack, and he told her fortune and said she would be visited by the god Ammon and beget a son, who would be the son of Ammon. So, and she described him as a gray man, very much like himself. So in the night, he comes into her chamber and consorts with her as Ammon. So the son she begets is Ammon. That was an old established, we have it in the case of Hatshepsut, we have it in the case of Amenemhes, we have it in the case of Tutankhamun, that the king was conceived by Ammon in such a fashion. There was a chamber where it happened. I could have put some slides up showing this sort of thing, nightlife of the gods sort of thing. But see, it was a matter, of course, that he should be conceived by Ammon here. And so on his first meeting with Olympias, Nectanebus read her horoscope from some wonderful star charts he had with him, describing them. They're very well described. Well, Alexander, as is well known, well, thus prepared, the queen had a dream in which Nectanebus came to her in the middle night in the form of Ammon, Ammon of Libya, the true father of Alexander. Alexander never denied the story. Of course, he exploited it for all of his worth. And who would be king of Egypt had to have claim his parentage from Ammon, and who would be cosmocrator, a king of the world, had to have his lineage confirmed as from Ammon. So he made his famous journey to the Karge oasis, not the Karge, but the oasis of Siwa, where he consulted the oracle of Ammon. And we're told in Diodorus, and I think Orion also, and commented on a good deal, that there was no image there, that the image which he consulted was a round green schist disc with the image of the ram's-headed Ammon on it, and it was carried in as a solemn ceremony and so forth, something very closely resembling a hypocephalus. We won't go into that. So the he goes there, and Alexander, by his horns, from then on, remember, he's always called Dhul-Qarnayn, he of the two horns, and he's always represented with ram's horns, because that's the horn of Ammon. Those are the horns of Ammon. He has to do that. all these rites are connected, you see, with those early Ammon rites and the rest of it. But he not only wore his horns to impress the Greeks, as Milne insists, but even more concerned with being accepted by the Egyptians, having already entered the country and laid out plans for the city of Alexandria. Every pharaoh, as Maspero points out, was expected to be a descendant of Ammon through Re. It's Re who comes down, you see, and visits the desk. Zendi notes, it's impossible to tell whether the text conceives Ammon as the heavenly king or Pharaoh as the representative of Ammon. Since Egypt itself was identified with the cosmos, at any rate, the king was the center and a certain divine power was concentrated in him. So the son of Ammon, as well as Ammon, wears the Ammon's horns as Dionysus. The model followed by Alexander and the other Ptolemies on their coins are always represented with the curly horns. It was particularly once the concern of usurpers to secure this form of identity. Well, the hero, after leaving the Siwa Oasis, he asked who his father was, and it was Ammon. And then he asked the question you ask everywhere, will I live long? How long will, this has worried him sick, he's going to die. This is very important because the subject has to do with death and resurrection. Am I going to die? And he was given the answer he gets everywhere. Don't ask for a long life and don't ask to know how long, but you will be immortal after you die, and as an immortal on the earth. And he ordered all his people to address him as the son of Ammon. At times he even dressed up as Ammon, Athanasius tells us, and thus entered the spirit of the ancient Egyptian court masquerade. But the time limit set to his glory never ceased to worry him. In fact, it became an obsession with him. Wherever he went on his world conquest, he sought out the most renowned oracles, and always with the same questions. How long will I live? Will I be ever victorious? And never got the answer he wanted, except the victories. At Siwa, the oracle of Ammon told him, if you want ageless youth, after circulating the cosmos, build a five-hill city. The sacred numbers and dimensions of the new city are described. Alexander's image was to stand right in the center. Now you have your cosmic pattern again, you see. And after the more immemorial custom of the pharaohs, he sent birds flying in all the four directions to announce to all the regions of the earth that he had taken over the city, which was the custom from the earliest times. The city laid out on a cosmic plan, and in the center, Alexander built a huge altar, quote, to whatever god gazes upon the boundless cosmos from the center. That's our figure one in our hypocephalus, to whatever god gazes upon the boundless, that is, in all directions, on the boundless cosmos. Then he proceeded to sacrifice on the altar. And as he was sacrificing, a giant eagle swept down and took the meat from the altar and flew with it to a ruined altar, which dated, we're told, from the time of the first fathers, where stood two obelisks bearing the inscription, belonging to the Basileus, man's the emperor, the Cosmocrator Sheshonk, and king of Egypt. Sheshonk, Cosmocrator, erected this to the glorious god of the cosmos, Serapis. Well, what did Alexander do then? He said, O greatest Serapis, if you are the god of the cosmos, show me. So the great god appeared to him in a dream. So Alexander makes his ascent now. Here's another ascension story. If you show me. So the greatest god appeared to him in a dream, telling him that the eagle was the sign. He says, can't you see that I am the god who governs all things? As to the most urgent question was the reply, it is best for mortals not to think of this life as eternal. It is best not to know the future. Then we're told the god returned to himself, and Alexander continued his journey into Egypt, where at every capital, the local prophets bearing their own local gods hailed him as the new Sheshonk, the Cosmocrator. Again, our name here, you see. Arriving in Memphis, he was crowned and enthroned in the temple of Ptah, the creator, often shown in the Khnum form as ram-headed. Well, this poignant question of Alexander, incidentally, was never answered to his satisfaction. It's the cry that we find in our hypocephalus drama, remember, where you say, come and rescue me, save me from death, and so forth. Remember, he is praying for deliverance. For by way of reply, the gods, this is another source now we're using here, a good one too. By way of reply, the god takes Alexander by the hand and bears him aloft. Now he's going to make the ascension, you see, to an exceeding great mountain. It's our old ascension motif. The purpose of taking him there is to show him that his name will become immortal. Alexander asks to be shown what will happen, and the city of Alexandria, the new Zion, is unfolded to his view in all its glory following the pattern of the cosmos itself. He is told that many will worship him in that place and that he will be, quote, apotheosized, dead but not dead. Those who noticed in the ascension, the person always is someone who dies but does not die. Here, Alexander, we're told, in just so many words, will be dead but not dead when he's taken aloft in his ascension. He is shown a chart. Now he's shown a chart with numbers and dimensions of the greatness, showing the greatness of the God, which are to be applied to the city. And upon awakening, he recognizes that it was the great Serapis, God of all things. He ordered a great altar inscribed with the lines from the Iliad, the first work of the Iliad, and identified the God with Kronos Zeus, and set about designing his city on the cosmic pattern which he had beheld when he was taken on high. So this is the same sort of thing. Remember, Abraham, when he comes back, is told to make a diagram which this is supposed to be for his children. Well, bearing the inscription on its base, then what happens next? Then he finds a statue bearing the inscription on its base. The outcast king shall come to Egypt, not an old man, but as a young man, and will overthrow our enemies, the Persians. The priest explained to Alexander when he asked, "This is our last king, Nectanebus." This is where the ancient shrine was, where he built the new altar. Whereupon the hero threw his arms around the statue, exclaiming, "This is my father." The world already knew that Amun was his father, and this clinched it with the Egyptians. He was indeed the new Sheshonk, and the Latin writers always call Alexander Sheshonk Jr., which he was. But the man who claimed rule in Egypt at the time was Darius I, who also had taken to himself the name Sesostris when he became Pharaoh of Egypt. So he had to get rid of him, and as we know, he did. And then, after he'd taken care of him and Porus in Egypt, leaving India, Alexander went west by the southern route, as he writes in a letter to Aristotle, and came to a marble stela, or a common column bearing the inscription, "Sheshonk, the Cosmocrator, made a cistern here for those sailing the Red Sea." Like Abraham, he performed benefactions for his fellows along the route, you see. This column, he was told, marked the limits of the earlier Sheshonkid's world conquest, and it bore out the prophecy of the oracle that this Sheshonk would exceed the former Sheshonk. Like Abraham, he performed this. The column marked the limits of the early Sheshonk's work, which Alexander had now surpassed, as had been prophesied by the Libyan Amun. Next, he approaches the famous realm of the famous queen Candace of Meroe in the Upper Nile. After writing her a letter requesting her to bring an ancient image of Amun, a strong supporter of Candace in war, and he's entertained by him, and she speaks to him like a real stepmother. Well, the very same way that Bilqis made a monkey of Solomon and Tomiris cut Cyrus down to size, she recognizes his disguise instantly. She's a very impressive woman, and she intimidates the great Alexander very properly. Then she sends him out with her son, Candales, on her way with her blessing and so forth. She says to him, talking to him, he doesn't know that she knows who he is. "When any man thinks he is very great," he tells her guest, "there's always another who thinks he is greater." Alexander left the place, escorted by the king's son, now this is important, Candales, who leads him to a cave, which he says is frequented by the gods. With a few men, Alexander enters the place and finds the chamber filled with a glowing mist, illuminated by stars which glittered on the ceiling. He passes into another chamber in which he saw, quote, "people reclining, their eyes glowing with strange beams of light." One of them spoke to him, "Hail, Alexander, do you know who I am?" "No, my lord, I am Sheshonk, the Cosmocrator and Basileus, who has become the associate of the gods. But my name will never be as immortal as yours." There's a break in the text. After which Sheshonk is answering the usual question, saying, "It is not for a mortal to know when he will die." In one manuscript, Sheshonk says, "Though I subjected the entire world and enslaved its inhabitants, I still remain anonymous. But you will become universally renowned for building the divine city of Alexander. But go on in and behold the structure and organization of the entire cosmos." Accordingly, the king moved on and saw again the shining mist, but this time he sees a god sitting upon the throne. It was the Lord Serapis, a conflated version of Apis and Osiris, which Alexander's successors in Egypt adopted as the official form of the patron deity, of course. He says, I beheld thee, and when he sees the statue of Serapis there, he says, I beheld thee in the regions of Libya seated on the throne. It was the Libyan Ammon, you see. He says to the figure, and now I am beholding you here again. It was Ammon. Then standing next to Alexander, Sheshonq explains how this is possible. Because this is Ammon, this is our figure number one again. This one appears to be everywhere in the same place, just like the sky above us seems to be everywhere. Wherever you go, it will be there. It does not move, like our figure one. To this one, too, Alexander addresses his perennial question, O Lord and God, how many years will I live? In the standard text, Alexander, upon leaving the cave, is met by a delegation of satraps who crown him and place the royal robe upon him. Well, now, here we have the succession of the three chambers. If you've been to Opet, which the French jealously keep closed most of the time, or at Dendera, which you can get into, the Easter complex, as Domas calls it, on the ceiling, the French study that one especially, you will see, and in all the important, you see the so-called the three chambers, which the French archaeologists long ago gave the name of the Groupe Dogmatique, or les chambres mysterieuses, the mysterious chamber, the dogmatic group. There are three chambers. I think we have them here because we made pictures of them at, in chamber number one, this is what you find, you see, a suite like the Temple of Opet, to which Rasmonte applies such terms. As well, we find it in the Pyramid of Unas, as Spiegel says, and in Dendera on the roof of the palace. As Dehorak describes this complex, such is the symbolic rule which prevailed under the general way in the conception and plan of the group dogmatique in the Egyptian temples. The decorations of the three rooms correspond to the three regions of the zenith, the west, and the three stations of the divine epic. Three regions of the east, the zenith, and the west, rather. You start up in the east, you reach the zenith, and you go down in the west. I'll follow up here. Arranged as the three sessions of the divine epic, which we have here, or as we would say, our hypocephalous drama. The east being the place of rebirth. He's being reborn here, and we know in that chamber, it's very dramatic. Again, my son took these pictures, so firsthand, you know. As Dehorak describes it, the Opic complex at Karnak, the first, this isn't the one at Karnak, this is the one at Dendera, the first or back room was small and very dark, representing the place both of death and of rebirth, the womb, the walls bearing the inscription, quote, the place of the begetting of the god. Thus begetting is preceded on the same walls by the passion. We're told, Dehorak says, the god has fallen beneath the blows of the enemy. This is our facsimile number one. See, these three rooms are facsimiles one, two, and three, as you can recognize right off. But he only dies to be reborn. His tomb becomes his cradle. Both the situation, the death and birth recall, of course, call for the lion couch, which is what we have here. We can, many of these pictures. In the Easter complex at Dendera, one begins at the end of the line, the death chamber, where one life ends and another begins. On the wall are seen figures lying upon the well-known lion couch in various attitudes of supine inertia to rising and sitting positions. The next room is larger. It's the famous zodiac. Uh-oh. I should go forward, shouldn't I? Not backward. We're going to progress here. There it is. Ah. See, this is very close to the ceiling because it's enormous and it's very low. So you get the impression, you go through a low door and you go out through a low door, get the impression of actually passing through space, passing among the stars. See, it's not to impress you as architecture, it's to intimidate you. Oh, it's this large, low ceiling that has the stars and the cosmos on it. So you go from the birth room, before it can be reborn, you pass through the cosmos, this is our cycle, you see, through the number two, facsimile number two, so to speak. The next room is larger than the famous zodiac. The huge star chart on the low ceiling gives one the sensation of actually passing through the heavens on the way to the resurrection, from the resurrection room to the next station, in which we find the coronation. You go out through a low door, and I say, this is an established pattern. Again, I'm pressing the backward button. Don't ever drive with me. See, now this is what we see at the bottom here. This is close-up pictures that Charles made. This is the door, bottom of the lower door. You have to squeeze to get through it. There's a good deal of this, these holes of passage in the temples, as you know, representing birth from one station to another. And what you get to is a coronation room where the king sits, both worlds sit, being hailed by all the gods. We can see it here going forward. And here it is, you see. Here again is the door you come through, and it goes into an open court without a ceiling. So you always come out to the open heaven here. That's important. It's the Easter. It's on Easter Day this happens, you see. This is they call it Easter because it's on the spring equinox. And then you get the king on the two thrones, the two lands. And here he's been being given life by, well, this Horus, yes. That's Horus Ammon. And here the Lady Hathor is giving him birth and life, both the female and the male side. It's a coronation scene, and all around the court, clear around, is this the processions and the people hailing the one on the throne. Let's see if we got another picture of it here. Oh, another backwards. We don't. There she is presenting life, and again you see the... You're squatting to get under the door. This is taken quite close up, you see. But the door isn't... Well, it's rather narrow. You squeeze through and it's low. But you come out into the open court and all is light and glory. Well, there's another thing. We'll get to that. So this is an interesting coincidence, isn't it? You emerge in the walls, which are adorned with a great frieze, in the other temples too, depicting a coronation scene with all the gods lined up to do obeisance to the one on the throne. To match this, Alexander himself...
This concludes the recording on this side of the cassette. You may continue the program by turning the cassette over.
Alexander, first he goes into the room where he sees these pictures lying with the shining eyes and so forth. Sees the one on the couch. Do you know who I am? I'm Sheshonk. Now I'm going to be resurrecting you. You're Sheshonk. Then he says, leave this place and pass through the room where you will see on the ceiling the pattern of all the cosmos. And then when he goes out, when he leaves that one, the minute he gets out of there, the Persian satraps are waiting and they put the royal robe on him, the coronation, the third stage. So he's passed through the chambre mysterieuse, or the three chambers, which are represented so nicely in our hypocephalarch. Turning now to the panel which contains the name of Sheshonk in the Joseph Smith hypocephalus, we discover that it contains other important details not found on the other hypocephali. Well, we should put it in again. I'm not going to go by it all the way because you've got to take my word for it that when we're reading it here, other people have corrected it, so we're all right. Excuse me. Autumn is with us. Well, so this is what happens in that panel. Remember, it's lines 8 to 11. And line 8 is numbered upside down, just for convenience, that's all, because the other side is on the right way. But this is what it says. I guess we should look at it. Where do we have the nearest hypocephalus around here? Can you insert one? Because we've got to look at this thing. It's important, you see. Yeah. Oh, here we are, yes. Now here we are, you see. Here's the first line. Here is O great God. And this is Sedger. There is the couch and its figure on the, it's the an S on the couch. Unusually, hypocephalus, that's an S, which that's the phonetic part of the word sedger, which means to sleep in a bed, to lie down. Lying down in the primordial time, in the septepi. It goes here. The S is the wooden column sign, meaning great, but in that case, it should have the arm on it, or the papyrus roll and so forth. In the others, it's an S. And sedger is the word here, and septepi is variously rendered as the time of the beginning, the first time, the primal time, non-committally. Usually they call it, Gardner calls it, the first occasion. It's pre-existence of what it is, you see. Combining the idea of time with that, he says, Faulkner says, of matter, affair, case, deed, or act. This septepi means the first, this is first, you see, this is time, and this is tepi, which means the first, can be the first matter, the first affair, the first case, the first deed, the first act, the first occasion, the first chance, or it can mean the timeless sleep. That's he's sleeping in eternity, see here. The next line, O great Lord of heaven, earth, underworld, and the waters of Nun, calls him as the great Lord, see, the great Lord, great of the this is a heaven, this is the earth sign, you see, and the underworld, and these are the waters. And this is an interruption that's been supplied. This part was damaged, we can see on the overlay, and these are some hieratic things that have been supplied that don't belong there. No wonder they stumped everybody. Of course, that does mean great as far as that goes. It means the word great. But you see, that was damaged. Well, it could have been original. Well, that shows us that this was made before it was damaged that badly. But anyway, he goes on and says, O great Lord of heaven, earth, and underworld, and the waters of Nun, the rest of the line missing, grant life to the Ba of Osiris Sheshonk. Now that's what Abraham prayed for when he asked Sheshonk, do you know who I am? I am Sheshonk. What did he ask for? How long will I live? And he was rebuked. Don't always ask for that. Don't always ask for a long life. You never know. So he comes the same way, but he's a degree removed from that. He's not an Egyptian. There are some things he doesn't understand here. He's always hoping that by going through these rites, he can save his life. Well, because that's their purpose, after all. The grant of life, grant life to the Ba of Sheshonk. The one on the couch is always the deceased, identified as the Osiris so-and-so, who in the ordinary hypocephalus pleads for deliverance from the powers of death, as Abraham is doing facsimile number one. Remember, he's begged to be spared, and the angel comes and delivers him, as in these other stories. So here in the cenotaph of Seti I, in the 78th chapter of the Book of the Dead, in the 3/12 spell of the coffin text, we've had those already. And on the rim of many hypocephali, we find Osiris Sheshonk supine on the couch, praying for his life, reminding us that Alexander's whole concern in the cave was for Sheshonk Amon Serapis to promise him life. But who is he praying to then? Well, this is Osiris. Sheshonk is praying for life. Alexander is Sheshonk, hailed as such from the day of his coronation and his funeral yet. Yet the man on the couch in the cave introduced himself to Alexander as Sheshonk and is the same. Well, as we know, when he went back, haven't finished the story yet, but as on his way, he died in Babylon, as you know, and he was given the grandest funeral in history. And on his way back, all the way along, the roads were lined with people hailing him. They'd come out of the towns and villages as Sheshonk Cosmocrator. And the priests of Memphis came out in their colleges and greeted him as Sheshonk Cosmocrator. So Alexander ends the story here as Sheshonk. But when he went into the cave, Albertus Magnus says, an old tradition, others, what he brought out in the cave with him was the Tabula Smaragdina, the famous emerald tablet. Now, what is that? So I'm going to talk about... Oh, I have all 10 minutes to talk about that. Don't want to leave that. The emerald tablet, that's the basic document of the alchemists, we've quoted someone here, on which it is said all knowledge rested. This writer, Berlin, say it has its origin in the outside world and crystallized in the Museum of Alexandria and so forth. The Arabs continued to study it during the Middle Ages. The European scholars of the Middle Ages took it over from the Arabs and so forth. The Christian mystics developed it, such as Jacob Behmen, and also it contributed greatly to scientific thought of such men as Sir Isaac Newton. They all took this seriously. This was the Hermetic record that came down. And what was it? Well, it was this. I'm going to have to go fast now. We saw those jades of the Far East. We got one of them on here. We can look at it here. I think we can look at it. That's why this was... we got to go through all of them now, don't we? Well, there are not so many of them. Little review here. There are the three chambers. Let's rush through them. Get our coronation over with. Now, here, there are many objects that perform the same function that look like the hypocephalus, and of course the drum is one of them. We saw the shaman's drum. Now the Egyptian tambours, we have tambourines. We have these, and they're the same size and the same shape as the hypocephalus. They're green, and they're used in rites, well, this in the rites of love, the rites of Hathor, and so forth, for vegetation rites and things like that. And these are tambour, there are many of them, and they're all green, and they're all look like a hypocephalus. In fact, they put them next to the hypocephalus room. Various things have the form. See, we could talk a lot of things about this. We're not going to talk about these. Just mention things that had the form of hypocephalus here. Oh, there's one now. Now, there, here we go, clear back to where is this woman beating her shaman's drum? Notice it has the signs of the universe on it and the stars and all the rest of it. She is a Mapuche woman down in Tierra del Fuego at the bottom end of Chile. How did that thing get down there, you see? And showing the idea that it's worldwide here we're dealing with. Here's another one. Now, this is very interesting. This is very old. Notice this is from the tomb of Pajere, and it's from the Urkundan. And here he says here, there, you come forth when you want to, any time of the day, when it's day or morning. And he says, it's his tekentel, there is lit for thee, tekentel en ech, a teka, a candle or a torch, in the evening time, at the night, at the burial, weben and tf, until the coming of Shu in the morning to shine upon thy bosom. You see? So already they had the idea of preserving the life, the light, until the spirit could return to the body again. And we have the same thing in a very early Coptic writing, Bishop John, Egyptian bishop, who says, if you write like this book, it's a book about Michael, he says, if you light a lamp, reciting this book, you light a lamp, and place it by the corpse, then the corpse will be kept warm and fresh until the spirit can return to it. The idea, see, that's the hypocephalus. It keeps the head warm, remember, until the spirit returns. Well, now what this was, we said those functions of the jades. Well, the jades, we got to get into them. I don't know where to get ahead of it too far. Well, now these are the prehistoric schists that were used for mixing paint, which was always malachite, which was always green paint, and they are green and faded, but they are green. And they're in the same room, number 22, upstairs in the Cairo Museum, with the hypocephali, because they show the development. They think of the hypocephali. They do. They make them as round as possible. And now here is the jade disc. And I saw in a recent article that it was the Chinese, you see, who associated the tabula smaragdina, or the emerald tablet, with alchemy. It wasn't used for alchemy before. But they were great alchemists, and they introduced it into the West as an alchemical device, and it was adopted eagerly there. There's long debate as to where this thing, which was, it was originally a star chart, just exactly as such as Abraham had, and it was used the same way, all this sort of thing. But then suddenly they started using it for alchemy, and then it becomes very important in all the alchemistic books, and on this, the secret of the alchemist. And here's your Chinese jade, but jade, it's green. It's always green. This is important too, you see. And then here we have, this is Hermes Trismegistus. He's the author, you see. Now, when Abraham went into the cave, the tradition always was that who we talked with was Hermes Trismegistus. Hermes Trismegistus gave him the Tabula Smaragdina. That's what he came out with. It was kept secret. And what was this? The main function we saw of the astronomical jades of the Far East, like the one we just saw there with the hole in it, was to maintain an unbroken tie, a beam of light between heaven and earth. Well, now that was the same function of Jamshid's seven-ring cup, which was magic mirror, also mirrors the same, you see, function. Well, we're told it was expounded the science of the Kaf and the Omega. Now, Kaf is we don't need to draw it on the blackboard because we haven't a blackboard, but Kaf is the round, the only round Arabic letter there is, the Kaf, the card K, and it makes a big loop. And Omega, of course, is the big O. It was always round. It's called the science of the Kaf and the Omega, the two great circles, embracing one Okeanos that surrounds us. So that circle does represent the noon, as it does in the Egyptian hypocephali, does represent the water surrounding the earth, as it does in the Shield of Achilles and so forth. And it says, this writing says, it's the great green, and its mystic is completely unknown. But it is always divided into three main zones, three worlds or divisions of nature, which Hermes thought, that's why he's called Trismegistus. He manifests his threefold wisdom in the three worlds. Again, we're right in tune here. Along with that is the great division into halves. down the center and in the middle. The first principle stated in the inscription being that the world above and the world below are united in a marvelous whole. This is the first point that they want to make in the Tabula Smaragdana, that's divided into the world above and the world below, and you cannot separate them. If you're going to have the cycle of creation, you've got to have them all. Of course, that's what we have in the Hypocephalus. A Tabula Smaragdina is thus a hologram. The man who discovered it brought it from the tomb, we're told, bearing a knowledge of the secret of creation, a tablet of green smaragd on which was written, this was written, quote, "This is the description of the natural world." So he copied the book for the benefit of those who came after. There's our usual story here. An early myth of the finding of the Tabula Smaragdina is the Crates story. This is one of the oldest, 5th century BC. Of course, that doesn't deal with alchemy at all. That hero, praying for deliverance from the dragon, is taken aloft by one who shows him the Ancient One sitting on a throne holding a shining tablet. It is Hermes, who is the Egyptian Thoth. Of course, they're exactly the same, the Greek Hermes, the Egyptian Thoth. And the document, quote, records that which thou hast seen, concealed from ordinary men, from Amal Abad. This is an Arabic manuscript from the Middle Ages, incidentally. It is copied from the Crates. And he orders him to write it all down as a legacy to his descendants. The earliest historical account is given by Ibn Tulun, who died in 884. He says they opened a small Egyptian pyramid in 903 AD, and in the coffin lay a venerable old man under whose head was a tablet it says white onyx here. That's nephrite. And you see, the point is that the green is as you know, that emerald is either white or green, and it turns colors all the time, just as the fever stones of the Indians do. We have a lot of spiel about that. Won't be able to read, but I got a lot of stuff on it. The Amal Abad. The nephrite, it was white nephrite with green stripes through it. White onyx or nephrite, which we're told is true jade. The event caused a great stir. Some said the man was Moses, some said it was Christ, some said it was Mohammed. Another such document of gold was found in Akhmim, under the head, well, BYU is, I suppose, under the head of a beautiful woman, a fabulously beautiful woman, clad in 7 rich garments. It's an interesting fact about the BYU excavations out there that the people have been clothed in a number of garments, wearing 5 and 6 outfits at the same time. And the mummy they discovered there a year before last was perhaps the most beautiful mummy you find in the Cairo Museum today. Of course, and this woman had, and she, sure enough, she had a hypocephalus, but it was gold. I walked through there a couple of months, 6 weeks or so ago, the Cairo Museum, and everything, if you just look, pay attention, everything is either turquoise or lapis lazuli, or gold. If it isn't turquoise, it's gold. If it isn't gold, there are the colors, the only things that count. And hers was gold here. And like the hypocephalus itself, the Tabula Smaragdina was thought to protect the body. And remember, the prescription for writing it, in fact, in the Book of Dead 162, is to be written on some green, a fresh green papyrus, to be written in green ink, but the cow is to be drawn in gold. See, it's always green and gold, a nice combination. So, did we ever abolish the green and gold ball? We shouldn't do that, shouldn't we? But here is a beauty. This text was first found in the coffin as queen, then to... It's very interesting. All the people that are written by the Tabula Smaragdina, one will make... might be mentioned in a footnote, but this is never gone into because everybody wants has their own theory how it was brought by the Arabs or how it came from Central Asia, that's Ruskin's theory, or how the Persians originated, how it really began in Alexandria, everybody. But no one will admit that it's very old Egyptian, and it starts out here in the 64th section of the Book of the Dead, it tells us. And this was found in the coffin of Queen Mentehotep. A singularly important chapter since it claims to be an epitome of the entire Book of the Dead. This renders the text cryptic and baffling, with many of those deliberate omissions which have successfully guarded the secrets of the Tabula Smaragdina, the Hypocephalus. Now, this is the 64th section. I have brought along T.G. Allen's, because he's always most like mine. I like that part of it. And this is the way it reads here. And this is important here. It says, you notice all the phrases from the Hypocephalus are here. The point is, this goes way back to the fourth dynasty. This goes before 2000 BC, 2700, 2800 BC. Well, we're in the first there, more 2400, yes. I am yesterday and I know tomorrow. Facsimile number two has written one side, I am yesterday. Remember the two lions? I am yesterday, I am tomorrow. And then it goes on, and I am the two-faced one, figure two, you see, whose manifestation is in the house of the sky. Remember, figure two is at the apex. He is on the, he's in the top of the sky at the solstice. And then it goes on, I am he who presided over the tribunal. Now we get the trial scene and all that, but he's the tribunal is the one who sits in the center. And we go on, I am those who draw Ray as their father, who become the followers of Ray in his great seat on the boat, you see, as he moves through the sky, the throne owner. This is our figure three, you see, the one in the boat. And four, and I made the glaze which Ta fused upon this metal. See, so this is a tabulus maragdina. It has a glaze. We're going to see what kind of glaze it was in a minute. It says, enter into the nether sky and come forth from the east. That's what you do in the hypocephalus, remember? You enter into the nether sky and you are born again and you come forth in the east again. That's the whole idea. Make broad for me thy paths, that I may cross the earth to the breadth of the sky. Thy light is shining down upon me. There we are again. You see the beam coming down to raise him. Rescue me, protect me, the prayer from the couch, you see. Protect me from him who closes the eyes in the evening, you see. He doesn't want to die forever. My name is in the temple. Remember in verse 162, I know my name. This is my name and I know your name, when he has to introduce himself by giving his special temple name. Well, withdraw from the resting place of Tachinan to that of Ruti. There's the release and there's the lion, the 15 bearers. And I have risen as Lord of Life, whose ascents are the seven steps. I have come to Letopolis, from Letopolis, the place of sacrifice, to Heliopolis. We all know about Heliopolis. To tell the phoenix about the nethern world, and of course the phoenix is on the Joseph Smith hypocephalus. That's the Benben bird, the bird, the Aku, who's there in the Benben. Cause thou that I ascend as the disc at the ascent of sunshine. Take me with you on your disc. Remember Ray, such a facsimile as the Leiden, says the prayer is, may I be one of your followers. The other, I am rising, Hena Ray, along with Zay. When Ray rises, I accompany him. So here it is, take me with you, Ray, take me along with you. Well, all of these themes are here. The point is the age and the circumstance of its discovery and its connection with this mysterious, about which volumes, library has been written, and nobody's agreed on anything about this tabula smaragdina, this emerald tablet. I have passed the sky, I have trod the metallic expanse, there's the rakia, you see. I soar on the rays of brilliance, there's your Ahu bird, the Ach bird. My form is that of Ray. I go the good road through the gates, for I am acting in behalf of him who is exhausted. This is 312 drama, you see. I have reconstituted him, I have rescued him, I have revived him who has fallen on his back, the phoenix, whom the dwellers in their hall adore. To Horus his eye has been given, his name is my name. Remember in 162, the reason he had, the first part of the prayer, he says, do not neglect me, do not desert me, for I am thou and thou art I. I am identical with you, and he says, his name is my name. My form is that of a lion. Well, that's familiar enough. The equipment of Shu is with me. I am Nephrite. There is the jade, you see. Behold, I have ascended. I am the possessor of life. I am life. I have ascended. This must be done on the first day of the lunar month. O reassemblers, may I soar to the sky. May I alight on the earth. Well, he goes on about the lion, even Ray. Thou art I. Here it is. Thou art I and I am thou. Thy form is my form. Says, who knows this spell ascends and descends in the God's domain. He makes the ascension. It is the greatest protection, as we're told, the cow is the greatest protection in our hypocephalus. Now this spell was found in Hermopolis on the brick of Malachite under the ore of Upper Egypt, written in real lapis lazuli, under the feet of this god in the time of his majesty, the king of Upper Egypt, Menkaure, the builder of the third pyramid, you see, by the king's son, Harjadef, who is a famous Egyptian philosopher. Well, this is way back in the early times, and here they find this. It's in lapis lazuli. It's under the feet in the position, which an alternate position for a hypocephalus. It says, when he was going about to inspect the temples, he found it. He obtained it by pouring out the largus. He paid a lot for it, and brought it as a desiderasum, as a present to the king, when he saw that it was a foreigner's secret, unseen and unheard. What is this, a foreigner's secret unseen? One who recites this spell must be pure and spotless. Lo, there shall have been made for him a scarab of nephrite, again of jade, and it must be adorned with gold. Well, there's another manuscript to the same thing that ends this way. It was found in the time of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Menkaure, living forever. His son Hardadef gave it to him after he had gone about, wherever he would, every day. He shall not be turned away at any day he wishes if you possess this. A truly excellent spell, proved a million times. Well, now, to get to the point. Suspended from his neck, Abraham wore a great round disc, an emerald, by which he could discern all that happened in the universe. There's a great deal said about this emerald of Abraham's. It was called the Eben Tova, the good stone, or Maguliot, the gem or pearl. It had formerly been worn by Noah, and Abraham owned it as a true spiritual successor of Noah. Book of Abraham 1:19. Remember, Abraham's successor picks up the covenant where Noah lets off. By which he merited the titles of Tzaddik and Tamim, righteous and perfect, and was one who walked with God. And all these, according to tradition, Abraham was before all else the seer. That was because God gave him the great gift of seeing the stars, so that the kings of the east and west beat a path through his door. We have seen elsewhere how, after delivery from the altar, Abraham sat on a throne and taught astronomy to the children of the 365 princes of the earth, which is doing in facsimile 3 in our Pearl of Great, in the Book of Abraham. The Talmud says that the great stone on his breast was an astrological table which our father Abraham wore over his heart, and all the kings of the earth, the east and the west, used to attend at his house to consult it. Abraham's great reputation as an astronomer and astrologer spread far and wide. The princes of the east and west would travel to consult him on matters. Moreover, this jewel or pearl which hung on his breast had a wonderful power, that every sick person who looked upon it was at once delivered from his affliction. It was green. The Tabitha Smaragd was often referred to as a book, and the Zohar tells us that Adam's book, which contained the celestial mysteries and holy wisdom, came down as an heirloom into the hands of Abraham, who by means of it was able to see the glory of the Lord. Of course, in the Book of Abraham says, and I, Abraham, had the Urim and Thummim by which I studied the stars. Specifically, it was a book of drawings or astronomical charts brought down by the angel Raziel, meaning the keeper of the secrets of God. In heaven it belonged to Michael, and on earth to Adam. It glowed with fire when Adam studied it. Only he of all the earth was able to read it. The angel who brought it to him showed him the order of the planets and took him on a tour through the entire cosmos, showing him every particle, expression used in the Book of Moses, every particle, and explaining the creation. He saw the whole human race before it. We're back where we started, a full cycle now, aren't we? The human race before its judges. Adam taught Seth the engravings, and Seth hid it from a corrupt world. Enoch was shown it in a dream where to find it, and it taught him the seasons, the planets, and the lights, and all about the earth. He hid it until Lamech, the righteous father of Noah, was allowed to find it. Adam's strict instructions to Seth and his successors was to keep the writing out of unworthy hands at all costs. Never let it get away from you, he said. Its authority may be claimed only by those who are obedient, and its physical and spiritual powers accrue only to those properly anointed. Well, we see why it hasn't been kicking around. By it, Noah, we're quoting another writing, scanned the heavens, noting all that was divided into light and dark realms of life and death, day and night. From Shem, it passed on to Abraham. The theme is picked up in the world's oldest book, the Sefer Yetzirah. You don't have time for that. That's good for a long talk. And Sefer Yetzirah is attributed by all the devout fathers to Abraham. He is the author of the Sefer, which is called the oldest surviving book. It is possibly the most studied and misunderstood book in the world. The crucial word in the book is Sefirot, derived, quote, according to recent study, this is in the New Jewish Encyclopedia, Encyclopedia Judaica, from Sapir, the radiance of God is like a sapphire. It's our tabula smaragda, a sapphire green. Of course, the heavenly city is sapphire. The stones, its walls are of jasper. You could show all these things. Everything is a green stone here. This book of creation deals with dimensions, qualities, completely devoid of magic. The sephirot can be crowns, midoth, mirrors, all related to a cosmic pattern. Tradition persistently identifies the Jews as the oldest owner of the Tabula Smaragda. Rusca places its first appearance in Arabia's hometown of Haran. The oldest Arab account is that after the flood, the Jews found it in Hebron, where Adam was buried. Well, then we're told that Sarah kept it in trust at the tomb of Adam, and that's where Hermes got it from her there. Others say it was at the tomb of Sarah, but it's Abraham's family, and it was in Haran, you see, in Hebron, rather. But some say it's usually agreed. I mean, Ruska says it came from Haran. That was its original source, which would be Abraham's birthplace, after all. It first circulated in the West in the Latin translation from the Hebrew. So it's a Hebrew book as far as that goes. Special interest to the Christian document is attributed in Revelation to none other than the prophet Zenos, not mentioned in the Bible, but certainly in the Book of Mormon here. It's our familiar ascension story. Zenos, he says, his senses departed from him, and he fell into a three-day trance in which God showed him all the future. He was also, as was also shown to his father before him, to say nothing of Abraham, he said. This includes the foretelling of the apostasy of Israel. He's also shown the pre-existence and the creation, and those who praised me who were born to be after in the world. Abraham, remember, was shown all those who were to come after him and so forth. And I will plant for me a great vineyard, but the fruit of the vineyard will become corrupt. Now, it's Zenos that tells about the corruption of Israel as a corrupt vineyard. And in the Book of Mormon, this Zenos is the one who tells the story of the vineyard in that endless chapter 5 of Jacob that nobody likes to read. This is very important. This is Zenos' picture of the vineyard, and here he turns up here. So all these things run into each other. This is the prophet Zenos to whom Jacob attributes that long discourse now. He says, things are not real to our senses. Since my eye did not know what it saw, I summoned my heart to teach me. Out of the flame that did not burn, I saw a spark which came down and spread itself out of a sort of foundation or plan of things. And this thing laid out was a similitude resembling an arrangement, a bronze shield, back to the shield again. Remember, Ezekiel saw the bronze shield. A bronze shield, but the fundamentum kept changing. The middle of it was divided into an upper and lower part, and out of that shining thing came images like people, and they moved about. These, we were told, were the future inhabitants of the earth, and those who come forth from the light of the hidden invisible place, and those who will bear the name of this man. Then Zenos says, my consciousness returned to me, and Zenos's conscience returned to him, and he did not know what he had said. He'd been having a vision here. So the story's all over the place here. Where's a good place to wind up here? Here's the way the Egyptians talk about this sort of thing you find here. Why the green? You have power, you have effectiveness, O Horus, Lord of the green stone, of the goddess. You who stride out greatly, strewing green stones, malachite, turquoise of the stars. If you were green, then will the king be green. There's a common theme. Even as a living rush is green. And again, your own papyrus plant is green of the turquoise of the stars. Your papyrus plant is green of the king, even as the living rush is green. The king is green with you. The coffin texts say, verily I have a green stone which delivers one. I am the green stone which comes forth from the lady of the people. Clay was given to me to seal the order of my family. Well, the rubric to this states, the purpose of the rite is to seal the order of a man's family, to return a man's family to him in the hereafter. It's very interesting that Alan calls the case of the Mormons in this case, because there are chapters 132 and so forth. There are a number of sections of the coffin text of returning, of one's, having one's family sealed to one, of meeting one's family in the next world. This is all important. It talks about the greeting your family in the next world and so forth. The Book of the Dead carries the theme further. The garment of new shineth, the seal belongs to his breath, turquoise and crystal were its months, putting an end to darkness, and so forth, and so on. But why green? Well, I could tell you that, but I don't want to go into this. Well, The book of the treasure of Alexander begins with Antiochus, who is the heir and successor of Alexander, you see. He built a special monastery to contain the precious tabula smaragdina that Abraham had bought from Hermes. And hearing of the treasure, investigating, a later Byzantine emperor took the measurements of the building, and they showed certain empty spaces unaccounted for, so he ordered the building torn down, and sure enough, there it was. Quote, the treasure of Dhul-Qarnayn and the science of Aristotle and the great Hermes was finally found under the wall. It was contained in a copper chest bound with Chinese iron, which was in another chest of gold, and a golden key, inside of which was a book of 360 gold leaves with each 12 lines of writing. On the chest was an inscription, this is the treasure of Iskander Dhul-Qarnayn, the son of Philicus, of Philip. He has deposited this summa in a securely guarded chamber, lest it be lost. Only a king may have it who is also a philosopher. And then, well, there were other tablets going on. But see, we have this tradition running in. Only Apollonius of Tyre could read it. I'd give you a case from Apollonius. Well, here we go. Apollonius Tyre, a quack who claimed this for himself. He was a friend of Vespasian who destroyed the temple, just like Shishonk. And he was a tutor of the Lady Julia Domna and so forth. But he claimed the Tabula Smaragda, and ever since then it's been attributed to him as his special procession. This is the story he tells. He picks it up, you see. And in various temples were erected to his name. His statue stood in the shrines of Alexandria along with that of Orpheus, Abraham, and Jesus. He was hailed as the true finder of the Tabula Smaragdina. As he tells it, I teach the way of wisdom. The hearer is one who has received the light. I am Apollonius, the Lord of talismans and miracles, who went into the dark tomb and emerged bringing the knowledge of the secrets of creation. It was Hermes himself who instructed me. I am Hermes, he said. Being sore afflicted, I slept, and an old man appeared who was in my own express image, saying, O Babylonius, do you remember Abraham? Alexander was Sheshank, and that was Sheshank there too. He sees his own image. Who was in my own image, saying, O Bablinus, that's Apollonius in Arabic text, O Apollonius, arise and enter into this chamber that you may arrive at a knowledge of the secrets of creation and thereby acquire a sketch or drawing of all nature. I answered, the work he uses, a model. I answered, I see nothing in this darkness, a beam of fire I cannot hold against the wind. O Bablinus, place thy light in a vessel of transparent glass so as you can have light in the darkness. Who are you? Asked Apollonius. I am your own perfect, refined nature. Okay, we're getting mystical and hermetic in the other sense now. Then I awoke happily, put the light in the vessel, and entered the chamber. Now he goes through this again. There I found an old man sitting on a golden throne, holding in his hand a tablet of green smaragd, on which was written, this is the description of the natural world. As another manuscript puts it, and before him was a book with the writing, this is the secret of the creation and the knowledge of the cause of things. I took the book and left the chamber, and so I wrote this book for those who come after me as they did before me. Apollonius deposited his final report in the Serapeum at Alexandria. The Arabic transmitter of the book says, keep it and guard it with your life, for there is no knowledge which I have not put in the book. And so we go on. Well, you can see that there, we have not exhausted the subject of this, and now I haven't read the contents. You see, in the form and the function and the context, you have the book of the Tabula Smaragdina, the gold, the emerald tablet, which Abraham always wore, and you have the Sefer HaYasar, which he wrote, which he's supposed to have written. And the same, they have the same content, you see. They're the cosmic picture, have nothing of magic or hocus in them. There's nothing mystical about them at all. It's the same natural history that you find everywhere else. And yet it's, well, I could read. There are 13 articles of faith in the Tabula Smaragda, and you match them up with the Hypocephalus, and there you are. In the same way, there are about, how many are there, 20 sections, 18 or 20 sections, in the Sefer HaYasar, which is the most for the Jews, it's the most mysterious, the most read, the most commented book in the world, next to the Talmud in the Bible, we're told. And for the others, for the non-Jews, the Tabula Smaragdina is certainly the most mysterious. There's been more written, more libraries written, and nobody's agreed on what they are. They must have reference to this somehow or other, so we're moving around in mystical things. Why we are doing this, I hope to explain to the people up at Rick's tomorrow, because I only have an hour to cover it all to them, and it's going to be more generalizing. It would have been a more interesting talk if I gave it here tonight, instead of all this, these weird connections and things. But there's more here than meets the eye. A good theme to name on is that there is a lot of instruction here. Oh, I had a good conclusion written, but I can't find it, I guess. Oh, there's some interesting things here. I'll read you with this. The greatest of the alchemists was Flamel, Nicolas Flamel. And Nicolas Flamel was not would have nothing to do with it, because he was a real scientist. He was he was a great and good man. He always helped the poor. He was a genius. He was the best writer of his time, a great publisher, and this sort of the other, and a real Faustus he was, and a very good man. But then he had a dream, and this is what he says. Well, what it says here. Flamel's introduction to alchemy was through an archetypal dream, which also had the quality of time-stepping. The vision, like the vision of Lehi, you see, was of an angel holding a strange book with unrecognized characters. The angel holds out the book to Lehi, remember? Well, to other people too, John. And obviously an imitation of the impending crisis and change. In times of crisis, as it was in Lehi's day, the angel appears with a book, so look out for angels appearing with books today. Well, the promise that he would later understand the book seemed strange to him, and the vision departed in a blaze of light. Couldn't make anything of it, but a few days later, Flamel saw the very book offered for sale in Paris. It was bound with copper sheets, and the pages were of very thin bark, probably papyrus, with a drawing on every seventh page. It was written in Latin. Thus, in 1357, Nicolas Flamel came into the possession of the Book of Abraham, the Jew. That's what the book was, the Book of Abraham, he says. And he never told anybody what it said. He kept it secret all his life, only produced pictures of the drawing, but never told anyone what this Book of Abraham, it was to be revealed at a later time. Very interesting thing, you see, that this Flamel described the pictures in it, but he did not divulge the text. There is this commentator says on that, Kunrat, there is just that fascinating intrusion of the irrational in the story which leads one to sense something abnormal about the circumstances. Even the paintings, though in full alchemical tradition, do not fit with the description of the text. So what have we here? Is there something going on or isn't there? Well, Joseph Smith has left us the Lord has left us with the hypocephalus and the invitation, if the world can find out the meanings of these symbols, so be it. And also, not to be revealed at the present time, or to be revealed in the own due time of the Lord. I think Brother Rhodes may have struck 12 when the own due time of the Lord came around. The first attempt, wasn't it, in all these years of criticism, nobody ever made an attempt to translate it until Michael Rhodes. It was a very easy thing. It was no great feat at all, or anything like that. But nobody would touch it. Many Egyptologists says it can't be read, it can't be translated. Hayes at Chicago says it's just a lot of nonsense. Joseph Smith just made those symbols himself. Well, he shouldn't fool himself. Well, as you know, I don't know how to end, but I've got to end now, and I wish to bear my testimony to the truth of the gospel, and this ranks along with the Book of Mormon. But remember, this was the Egyptian version. Abraham says this is the way they did it. It's not, remember, Pharaoh was a good man and righteous man, and the Lord blessed him with great wisdom so that he was able to make a diligent imitation. It was an imitation we have here. So as Shakespeare says, remember when he's talking about a play that's representing the Battle of Agincourt, he says, but oh, for pity that this miserable play has to represent such a grand event, insulting the great name of Agincourt. And he says, yet sit and see, marking true things by what their mockeries be. So this is only an imitation here. This is not the gospel at all. This is the way the Egyptians put it. It's only an imitation, but you can mark true things by their imitation, by what their mockeries be. And that's what the Lord has given us here as a very useful... It was a bonus, remember? It was a bonus. This was a bonus for reading the Book of Mormon. And we're invited to search and find it out. Well, thank you for staying so long, and I have got to get up at 6 o'clock and go up to Rick's. Oh boy, what a lie. Well, have I sufficiently borne my testimony? I mean, do you think that I believe the gospel is true? Do I have to tell you now? No, all right, I consider my testimony as borne. Amen.